Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
This week, we're excited to bring you the New York Times' Mike Isaac. Mike covers the technology beat for The Times out of San Francisco and has just authored Super Pumped, The Battle for Uber. Super Pumped chronicles the rise and fall of former Uber CEO Travis Kalanick and draws from Mike's reporting, which played a significant role in Kalanick's ouster by investors.
We wanted to talk with Mike because while the book focuses on Uber, it really speaks to deeper questions that we focus on at The Realignment, such as how state, local, and federal governments handle disruptive technological change, the outsized role big personalities play in our politics, business, and government, and whether or not capitalism and technology can deliver on their promises.
Let's dive in.
Mike Isaac, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me.
So, obviously, this book is about the rise and fall of Travis Kalanick and the story of Uber, especially from 2008 to 2017. But the reason why we think it's so interesting and want to talk about it is it's really a broader story of capitalism. It's a story about the way that these companies are financed, the way that narratives about what founders are and what the sort of roles these people play together. And it's also about like the way that we actually exist in our urban societies. Yeah. So it's actually a great opportunity to talk with some of the deeper themes we want to discuss on this podcast.
And particularly, you know, on The Realignment. One of the things, you know, Marshall and I, we work here in D.C., we are at the Hudson Institute. When you look at it from a policy perspective, from 2012, Uber, Facebook, Silicon Valley was the national champions of America. It was the post-2008 success story.
Yep.
In 2019, it could not be more different the way that both parties look at technology, and the rapidly emerging policy discussion on the right and left is really something to behold. And so from that frame, I think, is what we want to bring to the conversation. And but from that, I mean, I think one of the things is that we always kind of have to begin with a book like this is why does, you know, the development of these companies, why does it actually matter to you? So, for example, and I would posit, if you live in an urban region and you wake up, you ride a Peloton bike, you order Uber Eats for breakfast, you ride a Bird scooter to a WeWork, you match with somebody on Tinder, and then you make a dinner date reservation on OpenTable, and Uber to that location.
This is Sagar's Tuesday, just so everyone knows.
My Tuesday. I would posit that it actually has a massive impact on your life. So how do you see it whenever, as you cover these issues, how does tech and venture capital actually shapes American lives throughout their existence?
I think you just described the livelihood of like 95% of San Francisco residents at this point. No, but I feel like San Francisco, I live in San Francisco, right? And I feel like a lot of these, let's say, startup experiments in venture capital just plays out as like, this is your little test ground to experiment on how people might interact with these things, right? And so you have VCs funding artificially subsidized things, right? So maybe you got that Bird for like maybe a dollar or less. Maybe you got your Uber Eats for free. Maybe your WeWork comes at like initially $100, even though, and like all of these, they're selling things for a dollar that cost them $3 to make, right? Mm-hmm. So like probably, let's say 6 months of a startup trying to gain users, not just in San Francisco, but like basically any company or any city that they're spreading into, are going to do this huge push and try to get you on the service. And then, you know, someone somewhere says, wait, this business model doesn't work, or, you know, this push for just getting users is clearly not sustainable, so we're going to jack that up, and then you might actually taste the, like, real price of the McDonald's that you got delivered, and then things start to change. But I do think, like, you know, let's talk about just scooters for one thing. Like in San Francisco, I don't know about here. I have seen quite a few of them since I've been here.
I ride them every day.
Well, but in San Francisco, there were none. Yeah. And then there were like 10,000 on the street.
And same here.
Yeah, right. And they just, this sort of approach that I think VCs use a lot, which is just flood the zone. We got to get in before our competitors get in and make it a part of life. And it, people will sort of sort it out. So it does like crash into the real world in a lot of different ways and not always positive, I would say.
So the story we just told was a really profoundly urban one, though, right? Like this could have been New York City, this could have been San Francisco, Austin, et cetera. How has the story been felt in places outside of the sort of like coastal regions, right? Yeah. Like if you're sort of in the Midwestern city, especially even in a deindustrialized region of the country, how has venture capital and the companies it funds sort of shaped that experience?
Yeah, I think a few, excuse me. So a few companies have made it actually in the suburbs. Weirdly enough, DoorDash apparently does very well.
And what's DoorDash again?
DoorDash is like a food delivery service. It's competing with Uber Eats and Postmates and, you know, just one of many delivery companies. And delivery is like a huge VC investment area right now. But there are some that work in urban and or in suburban and exurban areas, and then some that just don't at all, right? Yeah. Some that are just sort of like Uber, kind of the economics don't really make sense once you get further and further out, and the amount of people that are just wanting to use them in the first place is not going to be the same. I do think that now, since some of these cities are so competitive, there are some VCs with the thesis that, you know, maybe we'll go to, I don't know, Detroit or something, right? And like maybe there we can start seeding some investment and it'll be at least somewhat cheaper, like that the overhead won't be the same that it would be in San Francisco. But I also think that the outsized, like the returns you get in if you're focusing on some of these big cities are much larger, you know, and VCs tend to swing big.
That's the business
yeah,
model.
Yeah, exactly. They lose big, yeah. Right?
And on that note, Mike, I mean, I've read your reporting. I read the Wall Street Journal. I try to keep up with this as much as I can.
Yeah.
I have such trouble understanding the valuations of these companies. And especially, particularly, a lot of my friends who are regulators look at this in the same thing. I mean, how is it possible? We're in the midst of this. Mike's book is very prescient. It came out right at the same time that WeWork CEO was ousted.
Very lucky.
Perfect timing.
Right. I mean, it's very much the same story. I mean, could you explain how a company can go from a $40 billion valuation to a $15 billion valuation based on a single story? What is the value and the productive capacity of that business that's such that it could happen?
I mean, so the WeWork stuff, I could not have planned it better, basically. Yeah. I mean, like, and that's the thing I've been pointing to when I've been on the road talking about my book, because it's like, it's literally the same exact dynamic, right?
I think charismatic founder.
Absolutely.
Big idea, transforming. Right. There's sort of this idea that this isn't just like a auto company. This isn't just a real estate lease. This is a platform, right?
Yeah, exactly. Platform being the key word in every sales pitch for a billion-dollar company. I think...
Sorry, you just looked exhausted at the thought of how many platforms things you've read. I'm sure you've got a lot of PR guys.
I've heard the word platform. God, it's sort of like take a shot every time you hear it, but then I become an alcoholic.
Right.
I think... that's the thing. The blueprint is basically that. You know, you have a guy, usually a man, who's just sort of selling this vision of the future. I think VCs are attracted to that in particular, you know, like I always point back to Jobs. Steve Jobs is like the model, but he's the, let's say Jobs and Zuckerberg post pre-2016 were the like platonic ideal of founders that you want to find, right? You find these people who can sell this huge vision and maybe they execute on it, maybe you're not, maybe they don't, but like that's the sort of idea. And then again, you go into one either highly regulated industry or just sort of industry that hasn't been really touched for a very long time. Say you're going to blow it up and then say you're going to, the market is not a $1 billion market, it's a $1 trillion market or whatever, right? And I think that it just seems like people entertain that notion and people buy into the, oh, well, of course it's going to be this, you know, this size market next, or of course we're going to give you a $10 billion valuation to get in or whatever. And like the incentives for valuations are already screwed up, right? Like to get in the round, you have to sort of...
And by a round, what do you mean by a round?
For some of our audience doesn't have a venture.
Yeah, yeah, sorry. I turn into San Francisco VC head guy.
You're in real America now,
I was just trying to say, like, everyone in San Francisco, you hear this stuff at, like, coffee shops. Like, when you just sit, I'm just hear about rounds. Yeah. So, like, you're a startup. You need to raise rounds of investment for your company, right? You go to venture capitalists. You go to, these days, more like private equity firms. Or like, it's moving higher up the chain of people who have traditionally invested in your round. Mm-hmm. And so a round is okay, we're going to raise, let's say, $10 million from venture capitalists, valuing our company at $100 million. So they get 10% of your company. Traditionally, the power dynamic has been that VCs and the people who have the funding have more power because they have the money. But now we're at this point where there's so much capital available to raise, you know, whether it's like the Fidelities and mutual funds of the world coming in or SoftBank, which is a whole, you could write a whole book on SoftBank and what they're
doing.
Someone's
going to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I want to, but I'm too tired, so I'm not going to. But someone will write
it. Anyone's listening, you've got a huge publishing opportunity.
I'm telling you, SoftBank is a whole book. But it's, but they, you know, they have this like huge $100 billion venture fund that they're just parking into startups. So the dynamic has changed so that founders have more options to get money wherever. And in order to get into rounds, VCs have to promise higher valuations.
And to actually go back to something you said, because this is important to the story here, why Zuckerberg and Steve Jobs are sort of the emblematic founders, because the whole point is that Steve Jobs was kicked out of Apple.
Yeah.
Because there was this sort of perception that he wasn't the right person for the company. They brought in a different CEO from a more traditional company. He then comes back and Apple does really well. Mark Zuckerberg, thanks to the machinations of Sean Parker, Mark Zuckerberg has a lot of control over Facebook in a way that wasn't the norm back then. Correct me if I'm incorrect. And he then is able to make a couple of decisions. For example, he doesn't sell to Yahoo when everyone is telling to sell to Yahoo, and that was the right decision in the long term. Yep. And then when they start the news feed, I think people forget this, but when people first had the Facebook news feed, it was a horrible product that everyone hated. Mark Zuckerberg says, no, we're going to double down. I have a vision for this company. This is where our value is going to come from. And he made those decisions correctly. So I think the reason why these sort of, not charismatic per se, but these, let's say these like powerful visionary founders become so important to the story is that you have these very visceral examples of founders making these great calls that then lead to a lot of value for a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think that, I think you're totally right. And they didn't, to your point earlier, like it was not common to give some of the real favored terms to the founders back at that point. Like Mark, so for example, Mark Zuckerberg is effectively has complete control of the company. The board doesn't really, the board mostly just agrees with him on everything. Facebook is a public company, but shareholders can't really do anything. There's almost always some sort of motion at a shareholder meeting to have him step down as chairman or limit his power. And he's like, I thank you for your input. Please go away. The next one, right?
I mean, it was leaked that he said I would have been fired three times by now.
Right.
This more normal arrangement.
Just last week, The Verge had that leak. It was good. Yeah. He acknowledges it much. Like, they probably would have fired me, but guess what? They can't. But I think you're right. I think that's the question I have is like, I wonder how much over-indexing of like visionaries with good calls that we make. But based on like how many people who have just been real adamant that they were right have not done the right thing, right? But I feel like VCs are looking for that. This is the way.
And the reason why this is all important too, from a, you know, from a regulatory perspective, and from the way that we think about this, is that these people didn't just build companies; they were our champions. Like President Obama actually took the co-founder of Airbnb during his visit to Cuba. It was like, look at the power of capitalism.
Yes,
what
young
it can unleash.
Founders.
I mean, Mark Zuckerberg was at the White House. He actually put on a suit. It was a big story.
That was a big deal.
And like, this was something that Silicon Valley was so intertwined with the Obama administration and its vision of the future and the optimism of America. And it seems that so much of that has just fallen by the wayside in 2016 for a variety of reasons. But I would actually love your take on why you think that is. What has given way to that fallen?
Yeah. So my thesis, at least in the book, and you guys have read it, you know, is just there's this moment. I think in 2016, Trump is elected, and I think for at least a lot of folks in the Valley, but I think slowly spread over time is like the idea that tech had some, you know, nebulous way of affecting the outcome of the election. There's a very vivid article I remember that said Facebook was responsible for mm-hmm. Donald Trump, or Facebook was responsible for the election. Mm-hmm. And like, whether you believe any of that is true or not, and I still don't think we have a measurable impact of how much any of this stuff affected the election. Like, it's just, I haven't seen that. Mm-hmm. I think it planted the seed in people's heads that pervasiveness of tech is more powerful than we probably would have suspected or expected at this point. And it's not treating it as a bunch of crazy kids in Silicon Valley sort of building apps, changing the world and, you know, whatever. Like the thing that Mark Zuckerberg, I honestly embodied for a long time, it's no longer the way to treat it, which I think is probably the right way to look at it. I don't think you treat it as like whiz bang kids doing crazy things, but we've also moved into techlash, right? Where like mostly everything is bad, and you know, I'm probably, I mean, I'm a New York Times reporter, so I'm not going to say good or bad, but I still tend to feel like the pendulum will swing back towards the middle at some point, mm-hmm. you know, and there are positives and negatives here, but it's been so unilaterally. This is the future, Zuckerberg with Obama. This is the future of how capitalism should work, that there's going to be an equal and opposite reaction.
Well, that's the key phrase here, capitalism, because, I mean, you start, the book basically starts in 2008 operationally, because what you have in 2008 is not only do you have sort of post-financial crisis, Great Recession America, where there's a lot of capitalism isn't very hot right then, right? but you also have the iPhone, and you have the App Store opening up, so you actually have the ability, you actually have the tech, you couldn't have created Uber in 2005. You're actually able to have this company because there's the GPS on the phone and the accelerator, all these sort of things are happening. So how much do you think the tech lash is about just sort of like disappointment? Sort of like there was this like bolt, like people, there was an incentive on sort of the Obama administration's account.
Yeah.
There was the incentive from, like, frankly, like the free market, because this is a conservative think tank, right? So like I'm pretty sure Hudson or other think tanks put on pro-capitalism events around these companies.
Sure.
How much do you think is this a disappointment in the way the vision didn't turn out?
It's interesting to think about like what this, I mean, look, I think the iPhone, I think like folks were looking at the advent of the iPhone and the advent of like self-made embrace of, say, like creating small businesses, creating startups, mm-hmm. creating like, you know, this is what you can sort of do with, you know, by yourself. I think that was like a big thing. I think that was like, and it was, I mean, you can liken it to like Gold Rush era, like looking out west, this is like where you can find. Yeah, right, exactly. And that's sort of that. I don't know. I think the irony for me a lot of the time is, you know, in tech, the idea was we're countercultural. We're trying to remove power from where the centers were before and give it whatever back to the people if that's, I think that's part of it. And then they end up sort of becoming the new centers of power. I think that's
without
just
recognizing,
right.
Without recognizing that, okay, well, now that you have $1 billion company, you actually can't be anti-establishment.
Right.
You are the establishment.
Well, that was the fascinating thing. I mean, reading your book was like Kalanick, and who was the CEO of Uber and was ousted, he set it up, you know, he had this startup mindset even when they became a multi-billion-dollar company.
Absolutely.
With no compliance, shirking rules.
HR will slow things
down. Yeah, HR would literally slow down. And it's like, well, you know, maybe when you're like $5 million, but not at $5 billion and above. And I think that is really what it gets to. And I think the fascinating part that Marshall and I were talking about before this, which is you detail in this book, mm-hmm. one of the original fights were here in the city of Washington, D.C., the fight between Uber and the city. And at that time, the city regulators, Washington, D.C. regulators, were considering placing some sort of, not a ban necessarily, but a city ordinance and all of this within that. And that Uber weaponized its own use, not weaponized, but I mean, they asked its own users to act as its own lobbyists.
I think weaponized is probably strong.
And maybe weaponized is fine, but I mean, ultimately, Kalanick's thesis was not incorrect, which is our product is so superior to what you have in place that we can ask our users to lobby the government on our behalf.
Yep.
Now, the fascinating thing here is now the fight is not a local or city ordinance. They are now fighting the Federal Trade Commission, senators in Congress, the United States federal government is looking at an antitrust review. In a way, I think the D.C. fight and some of the other city fights that we're going to get into kind of previewed the government interplay with Silicon Valley today. How do you see that playing out?
No, I totally agree. Yeah. I think the probably the genius part of it was, well, first of all, I think it goes to how they attack things, right? It was city by city on a like a sort of local right. level, right? And they would create this playbook, create a sort of strike team of people. They parachute in, they drum up demand. They rightly saw that people enjoyed the product, right? Like
we were in DC in the early 2010s.
Oh, it was horrible,
right?
Yeah, it was terrible.
I remember my credit card reader's totally broken. Yeah,
no,
that's going on.
It's not broken.
Yeah, I remember that.
We know it's not broken.
Totally. Yeah. And that was I remember that when my wife and I were first dating, she lived here, and it was the same sort of. And when she first started using Uber, it's like, oh my God, this is
game changer.
It changed everything for me.
100%. Yeah. And it filled a need that existed that people didn't know they necessarily know that they wanted. Right. And Travis saw that and like what VCs call, I think Bill Gurley, who's a character in the book called it the perfect product market fit. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so he was able to rally people over to their side and sort of get them. It was sort of a weirdly populist version of like pushing for what they want.
When the narrative fit a little better.
Right, right.
Because I think the important context here, and you actually write about this in the book too, is that cities did not, so Uber when it starts out is first Uber black cars, which are like traditional town cars.
Right.
And like there's a long established, it's basically limo drivers.
Yes.
Established process. But UberX, which was the thing that normal people actually used, was I'm Marshall Kozloff. I'm going to drive my car and pick people up. So cities didn't have regulations for this. Uh-huh. So that's like, so can you talk a little bit about that? When you actually had the like intersection of, wait, this tech's moving so fast. Yeah. I guarantee you a DC city councilor did not know about the iPhone
right.
and
oh
how
God.
These things would play together.
Oh my God.
So yeah, please like get into that.
Well,
yeah.
it's this, I mean, like you just sort of what right. you were alluding to before, it's the perfect embodiment of how fast things were moving versus how government just cannot even like fathom keeping up with it, right? Like one of my favorite lines where when I was reporting on it and Uber would sort of push back against me is they had an amazing ability to find and exploit gray areas. And their whole thing was laws don't exist around this, so we can't be breaking the laws, basically. Mm-hmm. Which like is an argument. I don't know if I buy it completely, but like they would essentially said, look, like we don't even ride sharing didn't exist until we sort of popularized it, and now we're bringing it to cities. People clearly like it. You sort of have to reckon with this, and they were right. You know, like I mean, they have now formed frameworks around this in basically every country in the world because of how quickly and rapidly people adopted it.
And that's part of the issue too, which is whenever they create the industry, they tend to set the rules.
Yeah.
And this is a big fight that's happening right now in DC, which is about the idea about native capacity, which is if you have somebody who wants to regulate something, in this day and age, it's almost impossible to do that without actually working with the company itself.
Mm.
But is that a bad thing? I mean, if they create something, should they be able to help set the rules? I mean, it's a question that's really stymieing a lot of regulators here, which is, well, if Google created Google, then maybe only Google knows how to regulate Google.
Right.
Because these are super complicated. Yeah. They're algorithm driven.
It's not easy. No,
I don't, and that's the thing. I'm not unsympathetic to the idea that, like I mean, who knows this stuff better than the ones who made it? And like I do, this is a really tricky part because I think Facebook is in this position right now too, where it's like, it's getting hammered the most. Right. Yeah. And so Zuckerberg has enough foresight to say like invite regulation or be like, okay. And that's like clearly like an undercurrent of, we want to get in on that or help do that. And I don't think it's wrong to say that they should be involved in some capacity. I think you have to have, I mean, frankly, like the aides that are sort of feeding the congressmen themselves are learned enough to know like how to attack it in some ways, but I still think it's going to be more of a dialogue than just sort of we're throwing rules down from on high.
So let's talk about the other city. So we have DC, but we also have Portland, where I'm from, right? Mm-hmm. So in 2014, was it, right? Portland, sort of, the Uber comes there, and Portland had actually done a good job of I'm doing a native ad for my hometown here, but Portland did an excellent job of bringing Airbnb in and creating rules and regulations. But then with Uber, it was a little more, it was taking, wasn't it? So weren't they taking a while? And there's a little sort of like, because it was, and like you said, there was this gray zone where like there weren't regulations, so they're just sort of like, look, we're gonna come in. You've taken a while, and then you have sort of the problems of gray ball come out.
Yeah. That was, well, this is a sort of the next step in exploiting gray areas is like creating software tools to systematically exploit them, right?
Yeah, so, could you just give the background on what
So in, you know, in Portland, they had this sort of back and forth, and like the government was not going as fast as they wanted them to. So one of the things that Uber developed in-house was a software tool called Grayball. So initially, it was used for legitimate purposes on just sort of different parts of their app, but what it essentially did was they could use it to like tag a regulator with a piece of code. They call them grayballing them, and that person would not be able to call an Uber car or see like ghost cars.
And
who's
a regulator in the Portland context?
So yeah, exactly. So like the transportation authority, when so one of their weapons to fight back when Uber was like flooding in was to be like, all right, we'll call a car, we'll impound it, we'll give you thousands of dollars in tickets. And so Uber escalated that by saying, well, you're just not going to see us at all.
Mm-hmm. But they didn't say that, though, and that's the key thing, right? So it's so no one knew. Like, just, if you're just sort of a taxi regulator, if you're a regulator, it's like, man, I'm really having
it's
a
weird
time.
I can't
it's
call
my thing. This is crazy. So well, that was, so the it's so funny, the response I got. People in the Valley said, wow, that's a really innovative approach. And then the lawyers I talked to said, wow, that's probably obstruction of justice. Right? Yeah. But they didn't. That was
gray
the whole
zone.
Thing. They didn't. Yeah.
Yeah. Like gray,
that's
the gray zone.
That's the interesting thing. And we've talked with Matt Stoller on this podcast in episode 3. He talks about how there's a pervasive libertarianism within Silicon Valley in which there's the
and
idea.
Small, some of these people are Democrats.
And exactly. And it's not the libertarianism that many of our DC listeners might be familiar with. It is a belief, like fundamental. Well, he calls it lawless. I'm not willing to go that far. But it really is a belief that some of these laws don't matter. And they're just so behind the times that they need to be worked around.
And then it's a moral good to work around
And it's a moral
them,
good
right?
to work around them for the ultimate good of the consumer.
Yep.
Would you say that that's an accurate representation?
I think that's absolutely right. I probably wouldn't say lawless because there's some things they do respect, but probably out of the sense of like, it's, they would come down too hard on us, you know? Mm-hmm. Maybe there's certain industries that are too, I don't know, maybe there aren't. Maybe they're just things they haven't gotten to yet. But I do think that the end justifies the means in their minds, you know? Or just sort of if we show you this way and maybe exploit the gray areas while we're doing it, you're going to get to a better place in the end.
And I think that, well, the reason that concerns me is because there was a promise that we were all given with Uber and with so much of what we write about here, which is the gig economy writ large, is that, you know, in 2015, we're like, you saw all these billboards. You can make $1,000 driving for Uber.
Yep.
We were sold
way
this.
More than that.
But, oh, I'm saying your first day.
Oh,
or something,
of course,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, we were promised this vision of everybody in the gig economy can be its own entrepreneur, can work whenever it wants, and that ultimately it's the side hustle of the century that will add income for you to be able to like build a new kitchen in your house. Very much not the case that the gig economy has played out. Has there been a reckoning or an understanding of that, do you think?
Or let's actually debate that. Like, has, like,
all right, has
like,
it
right? So, like,
yeah. has it?
So, because, like, we could look, because I think Uber drivers would argue it's not great right now, but there are other areas where the gig economy has worked, right?
I think, you know, it's really interesting. So, in California right now, have you guys followed this AB5 stuff?
So
there's this law called AB5 that Governor Newsom is going to sign into effect, and effectively it would make it more likely that drivers could be classified as full-time employees rather than contractors. Contractors being, you know, they have fewer protections. They don't have to pay for, or they have to pay for their own unemployment and insurance. Mm-hmm. And so, which is potentially a death blow to the Uber business model as well as the business model.
Because they don't pay healthcare.
Exactly.
Like the side part of the gig economy is that, you can get off the clock whenever you want, but we're not paying you health care.
That's exactly.
We're not, there aren't sort of basic contractual organizations.
But as I understand it, Uber, didn't they come out and say that they weren't subject to that?
So Uber is definitely fighting that tooth and nail legally. I think what's going to happen is they're going to come up with some sort of middle ground hybrid classification. Mm-hmm. It seems like Newsom is sort of signaling that too. But the point I was making is like, I was on some radio show and half the people calling in were just as adamantly against the idea of becoming full-time employees as they were supportive of it. Right. And it was very, and I think it's really split. I think there are a lot of people who do see it as like, look, I drive X amount of time. Like, this is not my real thing, or I have another job or whatever. And then there are, a lot of drivers who are like, this is, there's totally, you know, completely tanking our livelihoods because I'm working twice as much to get the same amount of money.
Yeah.
So this sort of takes us to 2017, right, in terms of the story. So we have the innovation of the iPhone, we have the sort of local versus, you know, Silicon Valley dynamic. Now we have 2016, 2017, where you've always, like you said, there's the election happens, there's the drama of Facebook, tech is sort of painted with, I think, a pretty singular brush, so there's definitely what affects one company narrative we expect affects other companies. Travis is forced out, long story short, read the book to get the full sort of rundown. But
the big TikTok.
That sort of seems to symbolize for me the sort of end of the era where these, because I feel like if you're going to sort of put on your, like, you know, VC hat, you're like, no, we need Travis in here because Travis is the only person who is going to bring us into China, who is going to defeat these, like, regulators who are going to destroy our sort of things. That's basically the end of that model. How would you think about that?
I agree. I think, WeWork is like a lagging indicator of that too. I think Uber was like the top of that. And now I think the tragedy of like Travis is, you know, I think
he was not as bad as WeWork.
Right?
He was not like out of.
Oh my God. The WeWork guy is just amazing. I should have written a book on him. But the thing is, like, I think the best CEOs can grow and mature with their company, right? Mm-hmm. Or like maybe even, you know, with Google, they brought in, there's Larry and Sergey who were the original founders, and then they brought in Eric Schmidt to be like the sort of
adult professional
in the room. And that's kind of a model that has gone by. But like Travis just, he was, you know,
he wasn't a kid when he started it. He'd actually sold a company before.
Yeah, he was multi-millionaire.
Yeah, and he was like in his 40s later on. Like, and so that was the thing. People were like, I don't know if he just has only one mode. It might just be like, this is how he is. And maybe he could have changed, but maybe not. But I do think that now they're looking for VCs, like when they look at founders, they're still picking someone who's passionate and driven, but not like Icarus, who's going to just go down
and
with the ship.
This is a structural thing that we've focused on a lot here, which is Marshall and I actually were in Silicon Valley recently. We talked to a founder of a very successful company. Mm. He was telling us, you didn't have to think about the government. You could create a billion-dollar company before 2017 and not think about the United States government once.
Totally.
That change in the industry fundamentally changes who will create the tech companies of the future,
like,
and who will succeed. So what does that look like?
Is it the idea that regulation will probably harm the next generation of companies that might come out? Because I'm hearing that.
So it's not just that. It's just that you actually have to think about it. When you create a company, you have to actually think, like, what is going to happen when I am, like, dragged before Congress, when some, like, side effect, like when I move a little too fast, I break a little too many things.
Well, that's the thing. I wonder if that has a chilling effect on how you it's hard because...
Well, it does because, like, and this is the problem from the DC perspective, which is that a lot of it's in bad faith, right? Because it's tough because, look, Mark Zuckerberg has a lot he has to answer for, to be honest. But when he gets harangued about, like, how do you make money on your ads, right? Like, it's mixed, right? And there is, like, and once again, like, we could dunk on libertarians, but there actually is something to the idea that America's future technologies are going to help us compete with China are not coming out of DC.
Right.
They're not coming out of Senate committees.
Right. And I think that it's interesting now because I think the line that the companies have picked up on is very like nationalist moment, I think, and like there's essentially their defense, again, whether you believe it or not, is like, look at what China's like taking laps around us right now.
Well, that's the strange one, right? Is Google's argument, as I hear from every backdoor person who's met with them, is we are the company that can take us against China. And I would say, okay, but then why are you doing business with the Chinese government?
Right.
Why are you desperately trying to sign deals with China? So, like, if you want to be an American national champion like a Lockheed Martin, then you need to act like a Lockheed Martin.
Right.
And we haven't, and I'm curious to get your perspective from that, which is, they've adopted this nationalist rhetoric, but on a policy level, it doesn't seem to be playing out.
It's not checking out. No, I think that's right. I mean, all of their, it's really funny, this huge leak. Do you remember that this, so there's this thing called Google Dragonfly, which is basically a project to get Google search into China, right?
And
China
has a closed internet, which like is very, and this is one of Travis's biggest focuses at Uber was getting into the Chinese market. Mm-hmm. So there's this generic idea of like, whichever startup gets into China, like eBay tried it, Yahoo
it
tried
seems
it, everyone
to be a
tried
valley
it.
Obsession to get in.
It's totally, it's this, it's
well,
like.
It should be, because it's a massive market.
Right.
It's
basically how are you supposed to compete against the Chinese government? Because it's funny, I mean, from a more nationalist lens, everybody who listens here is rolling their eyes because they know I don't like China. But I'm reading your book, and I'm reading a story once again about how an American company in good faith is trying to enter a Chinese market,
right?
And how a Chinese government-backed companies, they were like, no, we will never let these companies fail to an American within our own marketplace. And so Travis is basically setting money on fire in the middle of China, I'm not saying, you know, some of that investor money was probably not given in with the best thought, but it doesn't seem that they've learned a lesson from that.
I still think it's this promised land or whatever of you. I think it's just the sheer amount of bodies in the and like if there's anywhere where you have like a large untapped population that like can be easily monetized than like other like parts of the world, right? Like everyone's going to be attracted to that, especially when all you care about is like growth, right? Mm-hmm. So you just spread to wherever that is. I think now actually it's very interesting. Google hasn't quite given up. I still think they want to like get back in. Facebook actually seems to have peeled off its obsession. You know, Mark was like, you know, I mean, he was like, trying to sidle up next to Xi Jinping for a very long time. He said he was going to name his child after him or something.
Second time that's been referenced.
Really?
Yeah.
Probably Stoller was
I knew it. But can we think for a second how, what if Xi had said yes? Because he said no.
I would love that.
You realize like 5 years, how bad, because this is back in 2013, how bad of a look it would have been.
I know, right?
During especially all this sort of stuff.
And he was trying to learn Mandarin.
No. It was everything he could. And I think only this year with the, you know, right now he's knitting together all the messaging services. They're going to go full encryption. And really, I think, has backed off of some of the ability to go into China. And so now I think they're sort of leaning into the, okay, we're an American company, and if you want to, like, let us compete, then you need to.
What's address this, though? Like, Arby's? I mean, so, like, once again, like, I'm center right, like, I obviously like the idea of like what's good for GE is good for America.
Right.
Like that, you know, General Motors confusing my corporate titans of the 50s. But basically, you know, there's only five of them. So it's like sort of easy to figure it out. But no, so it's like not an American company though. This is globalization.
Yeah, most of their users are not American.
Like they're trying to break into Southeast Asia. They're trying to go to Brazil, like where there's all sorts of like other problems with like violence and danger. But like, I'm trying to be fair to these companies and just say, like, look, this is my DC side. It's easy for me because I only look at things through a public policy lens. So, like, my job is to wake up and think, okay, like, great power competition with China.
Right.
What's happening? What are these companies doing? Much as, frankly, a member of the Chinese government does. But if you're actually a tech company, you actually, if you don't, if Uber doesn't try to get into foreign markets, Lyft will.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
at a core level, they're in competition. So, how as DC people, do we be fair to these companies considering the burdens they face?
I really take your point because I think about this a lot. I really take your point on like they're not like how do you tie Facebook is like a nation state in and of itself. So how do you tie it to the United States, right? Mm-hmm. The ways I can tie it here is just because,
Delaware incorporation,
right? for tax purposes, and then for just the idea that like most if not all of its product development for the past let's say 14 out of 15 years. Has been localized within Menlo Park, California, and San Francisco, right? So you have a very like Western view of the world and how things should sort of operate. I think Zuckerberg has now sort of figured out that the world is large and that Facebook touches a lot of more different parts and should be more localized. But like, it's a rub. It's like, how do you like you want to be an American company, but you're really not, and you also sort of have to sweet talk regulators in every country that you're in. I don't know. I honestly don't know.
It's an extraordinarily difficult position that they find themselves in, and I'm almost not even sure that it's possible because if you become
a global platform,
I'm saying I don't know if it's possible to avoid this because when you're a global platform, you're going to have global problems.
Yep.
And it turns out the globe is extraordinarily complex.
It's very difficult.
And that multiple different political systems.
We just figured that out, by the way, as we were talking. Wait a second. This is crazy.
World's not flat. Second time I've made that joke here. But, no, so it's like, when you have global problems, you have different systems of government, which are all going to want different things from you. And if your ultimate goal is to maximize shareholder bottom line, then is it on the company itself to decide some of those things? I mean, is it the job of the U.S. government at that point to step in and to say, no, actually, we're going to, because you're created here, you're incorporated here, and you have your development here, that we are going to decide in some respect who and what and where you can do business?
Yeah, I'm sure selling to the Chinese military makes you like money, but like, we
don't make you
really
quite
care.
A bit of money.
I think the other thing that is unique to this particular moment in time is that these, like, you can have. Let's say the American government steps in and says you can't do this, and it will have effects, you know, in far-flung parts of the world. Like, I mean, it's just the nature of technology. It's the nature of the internet. Like, business is created on the internet. Mm-hmm. Like, with Facebook, you know, there was this sort of Rohingya genocide in Myanmar.
Literally,
Burmese people were literally using Facebook to spread genocidal attacks on Muslims, right?
And that's the sort of secondary effects that you don't even, you could, like, who would have ever thought of that, right? So, like, think about what it means for the American government to step in and change something. Like, maybe it's the right thing, quote unquote, to do here, but at the same time, what is that even going to look like tomorrow? I honestly don't know.
What do you think of the sort of Tim Wu, Matt Stoller arguments that, exactly, no one would have thought that creating a global platform would lead to, like, genocide, but that's why it's too big, right? It's the curse of business, right? So, like, correct. You, like, they would say, oh, yeah, you're totally right. It's crazy to expect Mark Zuckerberg to police the Burmese, so it's like, don't let them do this then.
Right. No, I mean, look, I think it's funny to watch the FTC wake up right now after, like, being 10 or 15 years, like,
so the Federal Trade Commission.
Yeah. Just because, look, Facebook acquired Instagram. Facebook acquired WhatsApp. They're the two largest social networks in history since Facebook, right? If you're worried about anti-competitiveness, like, should they have been allowed to do that? I don't know. They're looking at it now.
That's an important thing. One of the things regulators here are looking at and are concerned about is the idea that companies in Silicon Valley are no longer trying to be true innovators, but that their ultimate goal is actually just to get bought by Google and Facebook.
100%.
And so, the VCs, too.
And the investors of those companies are funding companies who they know. And look, I mean, their job is to maximize profit. That's not a bad thing. But if somebody from a Washington perspective will look at it and say, well, the system is fundamentally flawed. Do you think that there's some truth to the idea?
I 100% think that there's an investment thesis or there's a company building thesis that says our exit is selling to Google because we're building X product, or our exit is selling to Facebook because we're building this. And, like, I mean, that's predicated on the idea that there are only one or two big companies that are going to exist or buy this space. And then and internalize, like, if you follow that thread, it means we don't have an independent future, right? We have to be absorbed. Oh, we're building an ad tech company. We're probably going to go to one of two places.
Right.
And, like, I don't know. How do you feel about that? Yeah. Is that right?
So I think this sort of takes us to the end here. Yeah. And I guess this is sort of what my concern has been as we've talked about this over a couple episodes. It's very easy to just look at the story you've told, right, from 2010 to other, like, obviously a sweeping scope. But let's pretend it's the year 2002, right? If we're interviewing, I don't even know what this would look like in 2002. We'd have, like, our MP3.
We got Winamp open on the desk.
If we have Windows Media Player going.
IMAX would be open here.
But, like, we'd be talking about Microsoft. Like, wow. Mm. Like, Microsoft, they totally, like, destroyed Netscape. That's crazy. Like, whoa. Like, and then we would look really dumb because then 2 years later, Google would IPO. You'd get Facebook. You'd transition from Web 2.0 to 3.0. How much is there a danger that we're just overly... And, like, it's good for you to focus because you're selling a book, but that we regulators and people in D.C. are focused on is focusing on WhatsApp in 2013 the equivalent of focusing on Netscape in 1998 in 2002?
That's a great question.
No, that's a really good, and you know what? This is where I probably have more sympathy for someone like Zuckerberg than Stoller would, just because Zuckerberg's point is, like, we have no idea what's going to come tomorrow, but it could kill us, right? Like, and the way things get killed, like, if you remember when Yahoo was, like, the dominant search platform or whatever, when they were the portal, remember when AOL, everyone had an AOL connection? Now that stuff, Google comes up in, like, a matter of years and just destroys it, right? And so I do believe that disruption comes very quickly and no company has a monopoly on its power forever. I think you have to think about whether you're okay with them continually swallowing up more companies in order to sort of like assert that power and maintain that position of dominance. And look, I don't know. I mean, I don't know, but I do, but I agree with you that like too much fixation on one particular thing.
So that's a narrative, right? Because like, well, like there's four companies, Facebook, Amazon, Google, Twitter, we focus on those. There's right. a couple companies that are not on that list, right? Because those companies don't fit into the narrative. And then to tie up the Microsoft story, Microsoft lost the next 10 years.
Yeah.
Like after, it wasn't just that sort of like focusing on Microsoft from the 90s would be a mistake. It's because like you had Windows Vista, Windows 7. Like it's not great,
because
right?
They were afraid. I mean, they were afraid after the lawsuit.
They lost focus. So it's just so tough because so much of this, and once again, like as you said at the start, these are narratives. You're selling a narrative. Like there's software, but so much of what these founders do is tell a story. Facebook's like, we conquered Harvard. Mm-hmm. We're going to take Columbia. We're going to take Stanford and go from there. It's hard to disentangle all that.
Yeah.
No, and I think now especially is the time. I mean, I love being a tech reporter because like looking at Uber and Facebook, really like all of this, like, what is that? Are they going to start getting freaked out to do anything too? Like I wrote a story a little while ago about Facebook pulling back on an acquisition because they're scared they're going to get slapped down by the government because they bought another social network.
Well, so and to tie a bow on this whole conversation, what does this actually mean for the future of technology? Your book, you've outlined, it's the end of founder control.
You call it the cult of the founder.
The cult of the founder. The way that companies get funded, government is, you know, kind of circling around. They don't know what to do, but they think they should do something.
Yeah.
What does it mean? I mean, are we going to live in an uncompetitive age or an undisruptive age because of this? I mean, that's what many, if you're pro-tech, a lot of people would say that's what the end result of much of this will be.
I think we're just, the way I look at a lot of this stuff is just part of a continuum or a pendulum where we're just very much in the, let's say, anti-tech, tech-lash moment right now. I think it's going to swing back just because, look, what are the options? Like, either we destroy all our electronics or go back into sort of like an age of Luddism, which is just not going to happen, right? Like, and the amount of things that we, I mean, I buy things on Amazon that get to my house in 2 days, right? I took an Uber over here before to
so
get here.
I,
you know?
Right,
right. Like, there's a level of convenience, of comfort, of whatever that technology has afforded us that we're not going to go back on, I think. I think we're going to just start figuring. I do think it's a necessary course correction to figure out what we are okay with and what limits we have to, people want to put on the things that we
use.
And
the other thing is do you think that Uber will actually exist in its current form in 5 years?
That's a good question. I think that.
And what is it? And one last thing too. Yeah. What is its current form? Because it's changed. Because like your story ends in 2017, but there's been a couple of things that happened since then.
It's the story that never ends. So basically, it began as a ride hailing company, and now it's a food delivery platform, and has bikes and scooters all over this place.
I saw Uber
trucking. Trucking tomorrow, not tomorrow, but like in the future, they're working on personal loans and payments and stuff, which is totally
what could
nuts.
Go wrong.
Like you know exactly. Everyone has made the okay. We've been there before. Golden. Yeah. but honestly, like the big question now that people, it's sort of this weird undercurrent of, do we need the founder vision to come back? Mm-hmm. There's this sort of weird Jobsian longing for Travis and like that passion. And Dara Khosrowshahi is like a calm, level-headed guy, but perhaps he's not like the guy with the vision that they want at the top. So I don't know.
That's so great because like I have to go back to our previous episode because the thing on the right, and this is the Peter Thiel argument, which is I think is a very good argument, which is they're like, we were promised a brilliant, amazing future. This is why Elon Musk continues to still be popular. I think he's probably like one of the more popular of the five because he talks about like solving.
He wants to go to Mars. That's amazing.
So on the one hand, our society is both condemning.
Yeah.
How lame everything feels. We're like, really, iPhone 11? Right. Like, come on, we just lost our
three
Apple
cameras. Why do we need three cameras?
I actually don't know. I still have my iPhone 7.
I work in media. I don't need three cameras.
but the point is like, so on the one hand, we're condemning the lack of vision, which I think is definitely there.
Yep.
But then on the other hand, we're sort of pushing a system that will inevitably punish or discourage vision. right? Like Elon Musk gets in trouble for a reason.
For going, I think people, at the end of the day, they like those visionaries, yes, you know? Do. Like, I think you can, you know, not everyone is going to be a flaming mess like this, the one in my book turned out to be, but like, people want to be inspired. People want to create the next big thing. People want that, you know, figurehead to sort of push them on. So I think we're going to come out in that direction.
And then within all of this, one of the things, it was an Axios article that recently came out. It talked about how the media is going all in on tech reporting. Now, you've been on this beat for quite a long time.
Since 2014, something right?
Since 2010.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But since on Uber since 2014.
Yeah. But something you write about in your book is how you unwittingly became a part of the Uber story.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you think, and I've noticed this, is that Kalanick and Adam Neumann at WeWork were both very much taken out in concerted media campaign, that the media was very much just as much of a story as it was writing the story. How do you see that playing out in the future? Is this increasingly important media tech angle into the development of these companies and, you know, the leaking against each other? And it just seems to be a new development, or maybe it's not. I don't know.
No, I think you're right. I think even in writing this book, I had to go back over my own coverage. I had to look at the history of like tech reporting, and I do think, just as we talk about that shift from earlier, I feel like tech reporting, or at least coverage, was largely like, look at this crazy thing or laudatory or whatever. I don't think there was enough scrutiny. I think we have again like sort of over indexed in one direction, and we'll probably get to some equilibrium. Not to say that, but I do genuinely believe that tech is a center of power and that it deserves its level of scrutiny, which is a lot. But I do think that like the vicissitudes of what the media deems worthy of coverage and scrutiny can drive what direction we go in. And I think we'll get to a level of like, it's going to be fair, but it's just everyone's going
balanced.
Like,
that's a constant theme here. Which is that things probably went a little far, and then they are going a little far now, and they're going to rebalance at some point.
I think so. Maybe that's too like zen, but I do think I think that's how that nets out.
Yeah, generally how things swing about. Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us. Yeah. We really appreciate it. It was a great conversation.
Thanks for coming.
No, thanks for having me, guys.
Clear?
That was great.
We hope you enjoyed the episode.
We recently began filming our episodes, and they are now available on YouTube. Subscribe to Hudson Institute's YouTube page to keep up to date with our latest.
As always, please rate us 5 stars and subscribe wherever you listen to your podcasts.
We'll see you next week.